South Asia studies. My question is in regards to private military contractors. The Uniform Code of Military Justice does not apply to these contractors in Iraq. I asked your Secretary of Defense a couple months ago what law governs their actions. Mr.
Bumstead, I was going to ask him. Go ahead. Help.
Well, I was hoping your answer might be a little more specific. Mr. Rumsfeld answered that Iraq has its own domestic laws, which he assumed apply to those private military contractors. However, Iraq is clearly not currently capable of enforcing its laws, much less against, you know, over our American military contractors. I would submit to you that in this case, this is one case that privatization is not a solution. Mm. And Mr. President, how do you propose to bring private military contractors under a system of law?
Yeah, I appreciate that very much. I wasn't kidding. I'd pick up the phone and say, Mr. Secretary, I got an interesting question. This is what delegation, I don't mean to be dodging the question, although it's kind of convenient in this case, but never. I really will. I'm going to call the secretary and say, you brought up a very valid question, and what are we doing about it?
Laughing about private corporatized mercenaries for the order have orders to kill from Iraq to New Orleans, and you clowns think it's a joke. No real accountability by the state except to follow the corporate state's agenda. No real accountability to the masses of people. They have target except to oppress, slaughter, and terrorize. Yet in raggedy America, that's somehow funny. Sisters and brothers, it's time to stop playing and get locked and loaded. And I'm not talking about locked like in prison or loaded like alcohol. I'm talking slave revolt talk. That version of locked and loaded. You know what the hell time it is. Slave time. Dig it. Listening to 103.3 freakradio.org in Santa Cruz with Skid, 104.1 Berkeley, 107.5 North Carolina, 96.3 Antelope Valley, propagandapress.org, savagejustice.blogspot.com, luver.com, the world, radiofraud.net, the universe, and of course, click into the slave web, go slaveofvoteradio.blogspot.com, find out what time it is tonight. I'm going to deal with some subjects at hand that basically means let's take a stand and stop playing. We got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3. Slave Revolt.
Is wrong. Hello, seekers. Here we go again. And hello, especially to the skeptic inside you who might still believe.
all over the country and world, for that matter. Black folks are getting their ass kicked. In the face of this, we have been locked into a mode of response that doesn't do anything but embolden the savages to continue to slaughter us. It's more than clear we need a more serious response to this madness. In this Ruins of Empire segment titled Negroes, Quit Playing, we explore this. In Milwaukee, an Afro by the name of Frank Jude was savagely beaten by up to possibly 15 pigs. We know at least 9 were engaged. 3 were tried by an all-white jury. And all 3 little pigs left the courthouse with a smile. Doris Jude Porter, Frank Jude's aunt, gives us a rundown of some of the elements that took place in this all-American great pastime. Check this out.
2004, my nephew Frank Jude Jr. was beaten near death, and from October to January, it was silence. The case was silenced until Frank Jude's attorney, Sanford, released the photo in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and that's how the community found out the severity, and even also the family found out the severity of Frank Jude's injuries and their beating and who was total responsible. The code of silence and the contaminating the scenes and no one coming forward also hampered the criminal investigation. We had to rally for months on end in order to get any participation with the chief of police, or because D.A. McCain said originally at first he was not going to charge any of the officers until the rallies. So therefore, and now I'm so disappointed, even the outcome, it was overwhelming of evidence. Even the jurors, they took the interpretation of Frank fighting, like you said, they didn't listen to the witnesses. The jurors, the witness, one of the ones who observed, and they said was so credible, Antoni, said they pulled Frank out of the truck. Frank was not fighting back. They beat him severely. They counted, and still they chose to ignore the true evidence and interpret it with the way they want. That's just like Milwaukee. All these justified beatings and homicide, the system have been interpreting the way they want, and it always come out justified, and we want to put an end to this.
So here we go again. And just like in many other cases that we've heard before, we've seen the various apparatuses that go into place on these types of brutal, inhumane treatment towards black. The chief of the police, of course, quite naturally did not want to make a move on all of these dog cops who had beaten his brother. Only when the photo was released and then there was an outcry, then some motion started to happen. But we know how their response is, so I'm not going to so much focus on that on this particular episode, even though I'll go into it. But It's more on what we are lacking, because that's what it comes down to at the end of the day. Because we'll be exploited till the end of time until we take certain types of actions. Now, when this cat was beaten up, this waiting for the photo release for the community to then become informed gives an insight to certain regions of the country where the autonomy and cohesion of the black community has been broken up in parts, where the black newspapers are no longer the vital infusion of information that once operated within the community. Because there's still black newspapers all over the country, you know, Amsterdam News in New York, the LA Sentinel, the Chicago Defender, etc., etc. But this emphasizes how truly independent networks, non-corporate networks, community-based information centers, whether in the form of radio or publications, have to be regenerated within the communities so that when these types of atrocities happen, a clear perspective based in the facts can be outlined, and then actions can immediately be taken. Because to depend on them releasing information or pictures or whatever, say there wasn't a picture that was taken of Jude while he was in the hospital, then much of the action could have been stalled off or completely neutralized. So this is why the rebuilding of these types of institutions, autonomous institutions that have always been a part of the black community, is instrumental. After all, our lives are literally at stake. This is just not some kind of, you know, off-the-wall thing. These are survival mechanisms, true community-like survival mechanisms that could have been in more than useful in the Milwaukee situation, just like they could have been more than useful in New Orleans pre the Hurricane Sam. Now, it's also fascinating that the typical thing, you know, where the jury said he was fighting back and they ignored all the evidence about Frank being pulled out of the car. See, this is, once again, the typical game where certain elements of the population hear what they want to hear. And they are going to defend those who are in the position to basically defend the state in the hierarchical structure. So, basically anything can happen to us. As we went into in the program I did, The Great American Illusion, The Slave Reality, where I played this thug district attorney's video cut, where he was basically giving up-and-coming prosecutors a strategy of how to exclude black people and why to, except for older ones, especially older males who may not be as paternalistic towards the black, especially males, that they're crucifying. He openly talked about how, you know, this is not about fairness. It's about winning. How you don't want smart people. You don't want people in the jury who are going to question or think, basically, and actually try to apply reasonable doubt to cases. Just showing the wretchedness of this whole system. He was openly saying this stuff and made a videotape of it. Now, she talked about how all these things took place, and now the basic strategy towards black folks is now kind of in motion. There's outrage over the not guilty verdicts. Now the strategy to deal with us is basically to have the chief of police say that he's going to have an investigation. And then various other agencies say that they're going to look into this case as possible violations of Jude's rights and all of that type of stuff. Possible federal charges. This is all a sham. As the former FBI agent who wrote the book Eyes of My Souls has openly talked about, this as a tactic because they know that many black people become outraged. So what in Conoco, Virginia, they outline was when these types of savage beatings and brutalities happen to black people, have various agencies say that they're going to do an investigation, put these committees together, have the FBI say they're going to be involved, so it looks like something's going on. It's all to simmer down the outrage and the range of action that the black community may come up with to deal with these types of inhumane treatment by the forces that be. Now, this is all a technique to dissolve the crisis, not the crisis of the brutality that black people face, but the crisis that could emerge by brutalizing black people. And then by the time, more or less, that these things have gone on and on and on, black people's attention is usually off to something else because, you know, another brutality's happened somewhere else in town and stuff like that. And then they just go through the whole motion again. So this is how the game is played over and over and over again. So my question basically is this raw and simple. Since we know that this is the game, why are these cops still alive? What gives them the right to live? If we don't have a right to live in safety, what gives them the right to live in safety? These are forms of state-sponsored and state-protected, like in this case, forms of brutality. If your mother or grandmother or great-grandmother, father, whatever the case, don't have a right to live, why do these people's mother, grandmother, etc., what gives them the right to live? This is not about trying to get these fools to recognize our humanity. That's been played out. These Negroes are quit being caught in a trap where you're always trying to get everyone to recognize our humanity. Always trying to get people to see us as human. That's not how this thing is set up in America. Don't worry about it. If someone does not want to see us as a human or anything else, whatever. But if they treat you in an inhumane way, make them pay the price. Negroes, quit playing. Because no one else is playing towards us. This is hardcore brutality that's taking place against us, city by city, state by state, and throughout the world. Now here, Jonathan Safran talks about Frank and Frank's male friend who were both taking dates to this all-American party. And found more than a piece of cake to eat. Check this out.
With another gentleman who was a friend of his, he was with two other women that were also invited to this party, and he arrived at the party, felt after he came inside, after only being there for a few minutes, as to how the reaction was of those in the home, that he might not be welcome. He felt uneasy. The gentleman he was with, Mr. Harris, is black. Mr. Jude is biracial. The two women that were with them coming to the party were white, and they immediately felt, in their words, bad vibes, and they left within a very few minutes and left. They were immediately surrounded by a group of up to 15 of the off-duty officers who were yelling, "Where's the badge? Where's the badge?" Supposedly, Mr. Spangler, whose home it was, who was hosting the party, claimed that his badge had been stolen. He claimed that he'd left his badge out on a night table in his bedroom, even though there were that was the room that everyone would come into in putting their coats on. He claimed that he left the badge on his night table. Drinking had been going on since approximately 7 or 7:30 the night before. This was, again, about 2:45 in the morning the following day. And he claimed that his badge, which had been left in open view, had been stolen. And these individuals with Mr. Jude were accused of stealing this badge. Demanded that they get out of the car. They identified themselves as police officers, continuously yelling at them, "Where's the badge?" Mr. Jude and Mr. Harris were literally pulled out of the vehicle by a number of these off-duty officers. They were immediately confronted, and things went down from there. Mr. Jude was eventually taken to the ground, and the beating began.
So once again, we could see that the cops were in violation of all their little laws, drinking up a storm, acting a fool. Got upset, it appears, on a little racial level. And then, unsurprisingly, like the cowards they are, came out in one of their Klan posses and proceeded to brutalize two unarmed cats. Classic Americano heroism on the American plantation. Now, this boldness is really, or should, send black folks a message. When you have cops act this brazenly, they weren't even on duty, but they felt secure enough to basically commit a hate crime out in the open in its most vile way. Life-threatening. Jude could have easily have died, but they're so confident in how the state plays these things out and how they'll be protected by the state and how their whiteness will protect them if they do end up in front of a jury, which is how it played out, that really this is not any different than what you would expect it from a scene in the 1930s. Had, Jude and his partner walked in to a scene with white males being infuriated about their companions. I mean, what fundamentally is the difference? Now, with that context, these are the real things that black folks need to think about as far as where we're really at. Stop all this nonsense talking about how much we've gained because when they decide not to steal the little vote, you can vote. The reality is that this raw, naked brutalization of us is protected at all various levels. Now, with that as a fact, and this is a raw fact, where they even psychologically understand it, these cops did this reckless abandon brutality in a cold, calculated way without any fear of reprisal by the state. Now, once again, I'm not expecting that. What I'm saying is, what are our alternatives? Is it going from one raggedy march with Sharpton or with Jackson? Is that the solution? Or is it time we start thinking of making those who are engaged in this type of brutality on a personal level personally responsible? Now, also, you heard, you know, Saffron say that, you know, Frank Jude was with a friend. His friend is black, and Frank is biracial. Look, they didn't whip Frank's ass nearly to death because he was quote-unquote biracial. It wasn't the white quote-unquote blood in him that caused those dog cops to go upside his head. We know why. So this little, you know, terminology, especially in this day of the game, needs to go somewhere. Call it what it is, and let's deal with it for what it is. Saffron now talks about how the case finally began to quote-unquote move, and some of the background of some of these jackboot cops. So check this out.
What happened was we had continuously been working with the district attorney's office as far as providing them with our cooperation, trying to gather evidence ourselves, independent from what the district attorney's office was doing. But we began to realize that things were not moving very fast. This was, again, now 2 or 3 months after this incident occurred. And although we were repeatedly being told that charges were in the process of being issued, it wasn't happening. And we made a decision that the best way at that point to try to move things along was to get this out into the public's eye. We then came to the Journal Sentinel, which is our local newspaper, had one of the reporters there do a very large article that appeared on a Sunday morning. And that just started the uproar in the community and eventually led, within a relatively short period of time after that, to charges being issued against 3 of these officers. On-duty police officers that were eventually called to the scene, and those 2 officers gave testimony early on in this case and provided statements implicating at least these 3 officers that were eventually charged, among others. And so the district attorney's office relied upon the testimony by these 2 on-duty officers to eventually bring the criminal charges against those 3 officers that were charged. There was a lot of drinking. There were a good amount of testimony indicating that a number of these officers were significantly impaired. And it is interesting that the rules that apply to the Milwaukee Police Department and their officers says that officers either on duty or off duty cannot be under the influence of intoxication, that cannot be intoxicated, cannot be under the influence at all. There were clearly evidence of significant amounts of drinking. There were 3 kegs of beer. There was significant amounts of other alcohol there, but no testing was done of these officers to determine their levels of intoxication, even though other officers testified that some were significantly impaired. So one of them, as has been reported, was involved in a significant number of complaints relating to the use of taser guns, stun guns in Milwaukee. The other officer, Jarn Bartlett, was involved in a police shooting that led to the death of a gentleman by the name of Mr. Jenkins. And he is a defendant in a civil 1983 case that is pending in federal court in Milwaukee. It is actually going to go to trial beginning, I believe, next week. So he has certainly been involved in some other incidents and, according to the records, was involved in a criminal conviction a number of years ago when he was involved with apparently being charged with fleeing from the police.
So once again, you see how the various apparatuses go into play, and that these cops, who by their own laws, once again, are not supposed to be intoxicated on or off duty, by some of their own reports, significantly impaired, yet no testing. See, our lies to them, it's just a joke. It's not to be taken seriously. And as long as there is not any accountability, it won't be taken seriously. Negroes, quit playing. If we don't have a right to live, what gives Bartlett or any of these others? These are the questions at hand that need to seriously start to take place. Quit playing. This is a minstrel performance going back and forth from one courthouse to one funeral, back to a courthouse, back to some protest in front of the police station or whatever, back to another funeral, etc., etc., etc. Negroes, quit playing. All of these cops that were involved in this brutality, yet there was charges only against three. That's they're clowning. Every apparatus you can imagine, from the chief of police to the investigation to the jury to the judge to the prosecution system, the media apparatus, all of these elements are telling us our lives are dispensable. And those who often like to act out that type of mentality have been given a free ride. That's not acceptable if you plan on surviving in this brutal, inhumane, savage country. Negroes, quit playing. Now here, Safran describes the beating scene and how, surprise, surprise, the beating scene was also compromised. So check this out.
Was amazingly the first responding on-duty supervisor was a sergeant who had literally been a sergeant for only 2 or 3 months. This was a chaotic scene as described by everyone, and it was not handled in the way that any of us would believe would be a normal crime scene. The area where Mr. Jude was being beaten, although there was blood on the ground, was never taped off. There were these on-duty and with the off-duty officers that were running throughout the streets, in and out of homes, in and out of bushes. And the four, what were considered to be the four main suspects at the time, three of whom were charged, were allowed to remain in Mr. Spangler's home without any officers being in there to watch them or separate them, which gave them obviously an opportunity to potentially compare their stories. Their clothes were never analyzed as far as blood, or their shoes and were never analyzed as far as blood. Some photographs were taken of their hands many hours later, but one of the officers who was charged, his hands and his clothes were never analyzed, never photographed at all. Some of the officers left, some of the officers came back. There's evidence that some of the officers changed their clothes by the time they came back. There just was no possible way that this investigation was handled the right way, and that led to obviously very great difficulties by the district attorney's office in having what we would consider to be normal, sufficient evidence to pursue their case. There were five counts and five verdicts that were provided as part of this criminal case as far as state charges. The jury was hung on one of the charges relating to Mr. Bartlett. The district attorney's office has already indicated that they plan to retry Mr. Bartlett on that charge. There are some other charges pending against one of the other officers as far as a perjury charge relating to this investigation. And I spoke to the U.S. Attorney's Office Saturday morning after this verdict came in late Friday night, and I have assurances from the U.S. Attorney that they will devote the resources necessary to investigate this, to pursue the claim, to get it in front of a grand jury, hopefully have indictments issued, and to prosecute. And I believe that if they do that, there will be many more officers involved. Hopefully all the officers who are present may very well be involved in this investigation, which will hopefully lead to other additional criminal charges and further prosecution and hopefully convictions.
Keep hope alive. This is a minstrel game. We're just in a national and international minstrel performance game. Yet this Shakespearean play has deadly consequences for us, for now, only. Now, when you watch these little TV shows, they always have these little pig cop investigation scenes, like it's so professional and all of that type of stuff. And many people buy into this fake illusion, so on and so forth. Yet, as we know, in the real world, especially when it comes to us, how is it described? As a chaotic scene. Cops are jumping in and out of bushes, running in and out of homes. The blood, where, Jude's blood wasn't even taken up in some of these spots. One cop's clothes were never even analyzed. Some cops left, some came back. Others just changed their clothes. This is not an accident. How are all these things always accidents? How is it always a mishap? You know, from New Orleans and the so-called FEMA and federal government mishap to this incident. These are not accidents. Nor is it an accident that the orchestrated all-white jury found them innocent. This is how the game is played. So once again, at a certain point, we have to start asking ourselves some questions about this minstrel merry-go-round that we find ourselves on. What gives those who are involved in massacring us the right to live? What gives these jurors who know what the hell is going on? And if the script was flipped and you had 15 black males surround two white guys, and then proceed to pummel them to smithereens in a way that happened to Jude. We know how the jurors would have analyzed the situation. So the jurors themselves obviously don't recognize our humanity. And once again, later with that We Are the World, Martin Luther King stuff, I don't concern myself with someone recognizing or not my humanity. But if someone feels they have a right to physically violate my life, then they, by their actions, forfeit their right to be on this planet. Everything else is nonsense. Negroes, quit playing. Now, recently, we've had another incident. And this one entails with a 14-year-old kid. It took place in Florida. he had been in trouble with the law over stealing his grandmother's car and a violation of probation. So he's sent to one of these boot camps. What Martin Lee Anderson then found himself in was a situation where his 14-year-old imagination, under today's context, could not have imagined. The next thing he knew, nine pigs within this boot camp order began to beat, lay on with their knee, press, and other things him until he basically went limp, which is clearly visible in the video. And it went on for a long time. He ends up dying. This took place January 5th. There was a nurse on hand that you could see in the video, not doing anything. Just let this brutality go on. It was clearly a Negro breaking operation, just like Frederick faced back in the day. Frederick Douglass, that is. Now, Siebert, the pathologist who initially did the autopsy, said that the bruises on Martin were probably as a result of trying to retrieve him, and that he actually died from a sickle cell reaction. For over 100 days, Jeb Bush, the state police, etc., etc., refused to move on the issue. After much protest and the video coming out, then the process has, quote unquote, begun. What kind of process? The same old tired line. Justice Department investigation, the FBI, and now the Sheriff's Department all say they're going to look into this. Have we heard this skit before? Now, Michael Baden, the noted pathologist, was commissioned by the by Martin's parents to give a second autopsy. And he said it wasn't from sickle cell. His comment was, quote, "My opinion is that he died because of what you see in the videotape," unquote. So here, once again, you can see the raw naked brutality displayed right on the videotape by these savages. Now, I don't need to go into the whole "they don't recognize our humanity" theme, because we know they don't. But my question, once again, is direct. What gives those nine cops, or whatever they were at the boot camp, security, henchmen, whatever, what gives them the right to live? If a 14-year-old teenager does not have the right to live, then what gives these brutes the right to live? Negroes, quit playing. When you have various elements drag their feet intentionally from every apparatus you can imagine, when you have pathologists obviously cooking the books, do they have a right to live? These are the questions, once again, we seriously need to re-explore, because the model that we're under in the present day context of the society that we live in is basically setting us up for a more prolonged and continuous destruction. Negroes, quit playing. So from Milwaukee to Florida, let's take a trip back over to our continent. Fatma Haroon, a Darfurian refugee, talks about what's now happening in the Darfur region of Sudan. Check this out.
It is isolated genocide. It is crimes against civilian innocent people. Killing, burning, looting all their resources and displacing them, burning them, is devastating. That's what's going on a daily basis. Civilians who are disarmed, have nothing to defend themselves, are being attacked by the Janjaweed militia backed up by the government troops, and they are being bombed from the air by helicopters. And this is going on, is being denied by the government of Sudan, but there are a lot of evidence and documents to prove it. Janjaweed are supporting the government. Our Arab groups from Darfur who have interest, and the government has promised them if they kill the African indigenous people, they will get the land, they will get all the privileges, they will be predominant in the area. And that's what they're doing. And they were given chances to steal and take away everything. Very difficult to make an estimate, but I can say up to 700,000 people have been killed, either by direct killing or by disease and malnutrition.
So once again, the cold reality of what we face is taking place right before our eyes. You have a situation where you have a clique, the National Islamic Front, who are basically elitist privatizers who want to maintain their elite privatized neo-imperial dominance in the region. They are not from their identity construct the majority, so they continue to wage a continuous war on segments of the overall population to maintain dominance. They, like Boy George, have been in a permanent state of war to maintain their Arab identity and stature within the region. A war against the South that went on for over 20 years. A genocidal war in the Nuba Mountains, where they literally had concentration camps set up. And now the war in the Darfurian region. Now, one of the things that's fascinating is that you've seen, quite rightly and righteously, many Arab states and Arab people decry what's going on against the Palestinians. You've seen many of them decry what's going on against the Iraqis. And you often hear them throw out terms about how this is a war on Muslims, etc., etc. Yet, when these Christopher Columbuses with turbans on are slaughtering fellow Muslims in the Darfur region. Yet, those Muslims are indigenous black people. You hear basically a silence that's beyond deafening, helping outline how, hey, some Muslim blood is better than others, at least to certain segments of the world population. Once again, I'm not here to try to convince anyone. The right for us to be able to live anywhere on this planet. All I'm saying is that for those who construct and conduct themselves in those ways, why do they have a right to live? Recently, various groups, oppositional groups, in Sudan released a black book. Basically, they stole documents and had access to documents that has been a long-range strategy of many of the Arab-led governments in the Sudan, basically since they've seized power. And basically, their overall strategy is a genocidal control strategy of divide and conquer and other techniques to suppress the various indigenous populations. Warfare and destruction is the only mode that they plan on operating in. Now, what's fascinating about this is that these cats who released the black book had the black book waiting for various people throughout the political positions of power in the Khartoum government. So there was a black book waiting for Bashir, the president, for Taha, and other leaders of this hocus-pocus, cultist, Arab identity, genocidal, Christopher Columbus with turbans, beards, and hijab, ruling elite clique. Now, my question, once again, is straightforward and simple. If you had the wherewithal and access to leave the black book inside the offices of Bashir and Taha and others while they were off in their mosque defecating out their feces, when they came back, instead of a black book waiting for them, why wasn't a bullet waiting for them? This doesn't make sense. You had access to these murderous thugs while they were off bending their heads into the feces of Muhammad. So why in the hell are you going to just leave a book that dictates and outlines what you and we all know? Once again, this is Negroes trying to appeal to various people's consciousness. This is like a universal thing going on. Negroes always trying to appeal to people to recognize what they're doing to us is wrong and to recognize our humanity, as if various elements don't know and just have other agendas. Maintenance of power, for example. Negroes, quit playing. Now, to show how long this aspect has been going on and how these things develop, Gaddafi, you know, out of Libya, had dreams of what was called an Arab belt. across the Chilean Africa. Now, one of that cornerstones of that, of his dream of this Arab belt, was he had to gain control of Chad, and it cut right through the Darfur region on the Anzu Strip in the north of the country. So he then started a campaign, a military campaign, against Chad in 1987 through 1989. And in the end, he was turned back. But this gives, this is something that's not, hasn't really been denounced, that here, this guy stomps into a region of Africa and has dreams of an Arab, a belt. This is expansionist stuff. And the remnants of that mentality, that he had dreams of this Arab belt, which went right through Darfur, basically had resonance within various elements that are now known as the Janjaweed. So here you have a situation where these types of elements still resonate today, and since the seeds of Arab expansionism are not really challenged for what they really are, it's like these things really aren't even talked about. Now, as I said, the Libyans were defeated by a Canadian force at Abu Dhabi in 1988. So Gaddafi abandoned his dreams. He began to dismantle what was called the Islamic Legion. But its members were armed, trained, and then still maintained and possessed a serious form of Arab supremacy. That legacy is what we're still dealing with, and is easily tapped into today in the Darfur region, where during Gaddafi's reigns, he tapped into various Arabs into that region on that particular wavelength. So once again, we see this whole aspect take place over and over again. And the genocidal consequences is something that we are forced to more or less have to deal with. But unless we start dealing with the various forms of expansionist, imperial, supremacist mindsets that basically have an ideology that we are expendable, we will keep finding ourselves in these types of genocidal cycles. None of these elements that engage in this type of process deserves anything other than our most fierce types of resistance. Now, in the Sudan Tribune, you could see this in the Sudan Tribune.com. It was an article, December 17th, 2005. Where it basically outlined how, quote, the National Islamic Front is poised to renew its special place in history as a regime that has successfully deployed genocide as a tool of domestic, political, and security policy. It joins the Turkish government, which was responsible for the genocidal destruction of perhaps a million Armenians during World War I, and the Nigerian government, which during the late 1960s was responsible for the genocidal destruction of more than a million Igbo people in the Bafar region of southern Nigeria. But unlike the early Turkish and Nigerian regimes, the National Islamic Front has been successful in its genocidal efforts on multiple occasions, including its previous genocides in the Nuba Mountains beginning in 1992 and in the southern oil regions beginning in 1997. These are ghastly precedents for current genocide in Darfur. Moreover, unless there is a fundamental shift in the political, economic, and military circumstances presently obtaining in eastern Sudan among the Baja and the Rashadi people of Red Sea and Kassala provinces, we may see, quote, national security, unquote, yet again take the form of genocide. The Eastern Front insurgency movement is in many ways the most threatening to the NIF's economic power. This by virtue of proximity to the vital oil pipeline that runs from Higlig to the south through the Khartoum to Port Sudan of the Red Sea. The military's response of the NIF will almost certainly be to create a cordon sanitaire along the pipeline in areas of the Baja and the Rashida, killing and displacing all civilians as well as destroying their livelihoods. This as a means of creating security, quote-unquote, for surging oil production that may soon reach 500,000 barrels a day. All oil for export must presently pass through territory potentially threatened by these long marginalized people of the East. Now, it goes on much longer than that, but basically what you have is an elite clique, like I said, that basically feels that there are expendable people in the region who have the audacity to be indigenous people who stand on the oil underneath, who stand on the ground underneath the Arab supremacist oil, the National Islamic Front. And thereby, with no different mentality that you see from Kissinger or whoever, or Brzezinski or the neocons, these people must be dealt with extermination style. Same mentality. You got a Christopher Columbus's with turbans on in a cartoon. You got Christopher Columbus's with yarmulkes on over there in Israel-Palestine. And you got Christopher Columbus's with cowboy boots on Sam's plantation. I say it's time for us to start thinking about putting all these Christopher Columbus's on the planet where the original Christopher Columbus is and resides. Hold on a sec.
Everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You see, where they've gone, they're playing with the universe. They're playing with the solar system. But they have no perception and no way to measure the amount of energy that's going to flow out from that light off is going to do.
Representative from Georgia, Cynthia McKinney. Recent incident with some pig at, you know, the House and Senate grounds has caught the attention of many people, especially many of the anti-McKinneys in the Republican and Democratic Party, who are using this to attack her on all fronts. This reaction is basically a smokescreen to hide why many of those ilk really hate McKinney. In this Beyond the Shadow segment called The Problem with Cynthia McKinney, we're going to deal with this subject here. So first, let's start off with McKinney asking Rumsfeld a little while back a few simple questions that should be quite simple to answer. Check this out.
Gentlelady from Georgia, Ms. McKinney.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Secretary, I watched President Bush deliver a moving speech at the United Nations in September 2003, in which he mentioned the crisis of the sex trade. The president called for the punishment of those involved in this horrible business. But at the very moment of that speech, DynCorp was exposed for having been involved in the buying and selling of young women and children. While all of this was going on, DynCorp kept the Pentagon contract to administer the smallpox and anthrax vaccine and is now working on a plague vaccine through the Joint Vaccine Acquisition Program. Mr. Secretary, is it policy of the U.S. government to reward companies that traffic in women and little girls? That's my first question. My second question, Mr. Secretary, according to the Comptroller General of the United States, there are serious financial management problems at the Pentagon, to which Mr. Cooper alluded. Fiscal year 1999, $2.3 trillion missing. Fiscal year 2000, $1.1 trillion missing. And DOD is the number one reason why the government can't balance its checkbook. The Pentagon has claimed year after year that the reason it can't account for the money is because its computers don't communicate with each other. My second question, Mr. Secretary, is who has the contract today to make those systems communicate with each other? How long have they had those contracts? And how much have the taxpayers paid for them? Finally, Mr. Secretary, after the last hearing, I thought that my office was promised a written response to my question regarding the four war games on September 11th. I have not yet received that response, but would like for you to respond to the questions that I've put to you today, and then I do expect the written response to my previous question, hopefully by the end of the week.
Thank you, Representative. The answer to your first question is no, absolutely not. The policy of the United States government is clear, unambiguous, and opposed to the activities that you describe. The second question.
Well, how do you explain the fact that DynCorp and its successor companies have received and continue to receive government contracts?
I would have to go and find the facts, but there are laws and rules and regulations with respect to government contracts, and there are times that corporations do things they should not do, in which case they tend to be suspended for some period. There are times then that the under the laws and the rules and regulations that are passed by the Congress and implemented by the executive branch, that corporations can get off of out of the penalty box, if you will, and be permitted to engage in contracts with the government. They're not generally not barred in perpetuity.
This contract, this company was never in the penalty box. If you could proceed to my second question, please.
The second question. I've forgotten what the second question was.
I think Ms. Jonas knows it.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. McKinney. I appreciate the question. I appreciate your interest in our department's financial condition. And we are working very hard on that program. I've just come back recently discussed.
I understand that you're working hard on it, but my question was, who has the contract? How long have they had that contract? And how much money have we spent on it?
In general, we spend about $20 billion in the Department on Information Technology Systems. The accounting systems are part of that. I can get you the exact number for the record of what we spend on our current, what we call legacy systems, and those that we're moving towards.
And who has the contract?
That would be a multitude of individuals.
Could you name some, please?
Well, I think off the top of my head, well, I would rather not. I'd rather provide that for the record.
That's not privileged information, is it? Well, please. We still have time, so please.
I would be glad to provide for the record. I don't want to talk to the top of my head and be incorrect.
On your first question, I'm advised by Dr. Chu that it was not the corporation that was engaged in the activities you characterized, but I'm told it was an employee of the corporation, and it was some years ago in the Balkans that that took place.
It's my understanding that it continues to take place. And
is that right?
Yes.
Well, if you can give me information to that effect,
I'm sure you are interested in all of the information that I have, and I'll be more than happy to provide it.
Good. Thank you.
But I would also like to get information from you.
Okay.
For example, the information that I just requested about who has those contracts.
Let me assure the gentlelady that we'll make sure that this exchange of information takes place. And Mr. Secretary, if you can get back with us on the Dying Corps story, we'll get that to the gentlelady.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll get back on both of the first two questions.
So now you can hear what's the real problem with Cynthia McKinney. She's a pain to those elements that expect complete adherence and rollover. Not that working within the system is going to bring about any real change, but there's contempt for any elements to question those in power, especially in this climate. So whether it's a reporter or whether it's someone in office, to have the audacity to basically ask questions as forthrightly as she does about, you know, these basic matters, is considered an abomination. See, it's not an abomination, as we've gone over on previous shows, the Dying Corps slave trade, where basically they went as far as set up their own little parlor shop and had executives had little girls that they actually bought and were using as their little sex slaves. This raw dog savagery. And basically a mechanic who worked for them turned them in, and that's how this whole thing started to unravel. But this, once again, gives a lens to the real psyche of America, because as raw and as brutal as this whole case was, it never really got legs, even though it kind of got out there. But just like the particular case with these raggedy priests or popes or whatever you call them, when they were fondling, or still are, little kids, how that never ended up with any real legs and didn't become kind of a moral battering ram used by various elements, the way that they use the moral battering ram for against black people who have kids out of wedlock. You can get into the psyche of much of this population, because much of the population loves to latch on to the out of wedlock black birth. But when it comes to corporate sexual butchery in the form of dominating little kids and purchasing them as slaves, you can see Rumsfeld fumbling all over the place. And then basically this gives some kind of rote response about no American is the American government is opposed to actions that you describe. Yet they were giving contracts out to Dying Corps right in the midst of that. And of course, quite naturally, he didn't know anything about it. Because this isn't an issue. This is not really their concern. In the same way that roids is rampant amongst pig cops. And pig cops have been involved in all kinds of incidents while roided out. Yet, the roid phenomenon, quote-unquote, centers around bonds. That becomes the moral issue of the time. The lack of integrity. Not cops with guns and a syringe jammed up their behind, but an athlete with a baseball bat. It's not sacred the lies that these juiced up cops take while full of roids, but what's sacred is some little baseball records that may be eclipsed by Bonds, who's accused of being on roids. Once again, you have a population that is trained when to jump and when not to jump, when to bite and when not to. And when you have someone like McKinney, who works within the ruling order establishment as an administrator, and challenges the administration apparatus on some of these issues, of course, that's the problem for those of those ilk with her. Now, she brought up the whole issue about the management of money and the trillions missing. CBS.com, January 29, 2002, an article was called "The War on Waste." It goes something like this. On September 10th, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld declared war, not on foreign terrorists. Quote, "The adversaries closer to home is the Pentagon bureaucracy," unquote, he said. He said money wasted by the military poses a serious threat. Quote, "In fact, it could be said it's a matter of life and death," unquote, he said. Rumsfeld promised change, but the next day, September 11th, the world changed, and in a rush to fund the war on terrorism, the war on waste seems to have been forgotten. Just last week, President Bush announced, quote, "My 2003 budget called for more than $48 billion in new defense spending," unquote. More money for the Pentagon. CBS News correspondent Vince Gonzalez reports, while its own auditors admit the military cannot account for 25% of what it spends, quote, "According to some estimates, we cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions," unquote, Rumsfeld admitted. $2.3 trillion. That's $8,000 for every man, woman, and child in America. To understand how the Pentagon can lose track of trillions, consider the case of one military accountant who tried to find out what happened to a mere $300 million. Quote, "We know it's gone, but we don't know what they spent it on," unquote, said Jim Minery, Defense Finance and Account Service. Minery, a former Marine turned whistleblower, is risking his job by speaking out for the first time about the millions he noticed were missing from one defense agency's balance sheets. Minery tried to follow the money trail, even crisscrossing the country looking for records. Quote, "The director looked at me and said, 'Why do you even care about this stuff?'" Unquote. "It took me aback, you know, my supervisor asking me why I care about doing a good job," said Minery. He was reassigned and says officials then covered up the problem by just writing it off. Quote, "They have to cover it up," he said. "That's where the corruption comes in. They have to cover up the fact that they can't do the job," unquote. The Pentagon's Inspector General partially substantiated, quote unquote, several of Minery's allegations, but could not prove officials tried, quote, "to manipulate the financial statements," unquote. 20 years ago, Department of Defense analyst Franklin Spiney made headlines exposing what he called the accounting game, quote unquote. He's still there, and although he does not speak for the Pentagon, he believes the problem has gotten worse. Quote, "Those numbers are pie in the sky. The books are cooked routinely, year after year," unquote, he said. Another critic of Pentagon waste, retired Vice Admiral Jack Shanahan, commanded the Navy's Second Fleet the first time Donald Rumsfeld served as Defense Secretary in 1976. in his opinion, quote, with good financial oversight, we could find $48 billion in loose change in that building without having to hit the taxpayers, unquote. So once again, you see how corrupt this particular society is. And the problem with Cynthia McKinney, for many within this circle, is that she has the audacity just to question. That's how degenerated this society is. To simply question. Because it's not like she has any more power to bring about change. As you can see how from various apparatus within this society and within the bureaucracy, this late stage of capitalism is so degenerate where they even tell the people whose job it is to look into this stuff, quote unquote, why even bother? Why do you care about this stuff? So this shows and outlines what state we're really in. And for someone like McKinney, with no real power, but to simply ask, hey, how about some information on those September 11th war games that you promised me? What's up with DynCorp and the sex slave trade? What's going on with the trillions missing? That's a problem in the current state of affairs in America. But here, Rumsfeld has General Myers respond to the four war games that were commissioned and ongoing during the 9/11. Let's see how he responds to this.
And we'll get back on both of the first two questions, but the Congresswoman has raised the other question twice now, and I'd like to have General Myers respond, because you mentioned it in the last hearing. And I think it'd be helpful to get the answer, even though we're on red, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman.
General Myers, go right ahead.
But I would like to have the answer in writing as well, as I thought my office was promised.
Okay, I don't know about the promise, Congresswoman, but could you repeat the question to make sure I'm asking the right question? This is 9/11 question.
The question was, we had four war games going on September 11th, and the question that I tried to pose before the secretary had to go to lunch was whether or not the activities of the four war games going on September 11th actually impaired our ability to respond to the attacks.
The answer to the question is no, did not impair our response. In fact, General Eberhardt, who was then the commander of North American Aerospace Defense Command, as he testified in front of the 9/11 Commission, I believe he told them that it enhanced our ability to respond. Given that NORAD didn't have the overall responsibility for responding to the attacks that day, that was an FAA responsibility. But they were two CPXs. There was one Department of Justice exercise that didn't have anything to do with the other three. And there was an actual operation ongoing because there was some Russian bomber activity up near Alaska. So
let me ask you this, then. Who was in charge of managing those war games?
In general, why don't you give the best answer you can here in a short period of time, and we'll. The gentlelady wants to get a written answer anyway, and then we can move on.
The important thing is to realize that North American Aerospace Defense Command was responsible. These are command post exercises. What that means is all the battle positions that are normally not filled are indeed filled. So it was an easy transition from an exercise into a real-world situation, actually enhanced the response. Otherwise, it would take somewhere between 30 minutes and a couple of hours to fill those positions, those battle spaces, with the right staff officers.
Mr. Chairman, begging your indulgence, was September 11th declared a national security special event day?
I have to look back. I do not know. You mean after the fact or before the
No, because of the activities going on that had been scheduled at the United Nations that day.
I'd have to go back and check. I don't know.
Thank you.
So there you have it. That's the real problem with Cynthia McKinney. She actually believes in what she's doing and believes in the responsibility of trying to hold the government accountable within the confines of her position. Now, we slaves know that basically she's running herself around in circles. But the fact that she hasn't been so corrupted in this modern capitalist stage of empire in America is a problem for the Rumsfelds, the Fox News, actually for the Black Congressional Congress for that matter. She's not as cynical and hypocritical as they would like her to be. Because she still believes that one can make change operating within the cauldrons of the empire. She is wrong about that. That is a problem with Cynthia McKinney. But the problem that they have is that she still believes that justice and reforms can be made within this society. And as you've heard this guy Buffoon and others throughout this particular show, they'll look into it. They'll do further investigations. They'll contact her later. From Milwaukee to the Sudan to Florida, to what you just heard them tell Cynthia McKinney, it's all the same. And it's all a game. They love playing on us. Hold on a sec.
Surprised because these incidents occur across this nation every day of the year. In fact, as we speak, I'm sure some are occurring now. As an agent with the FBI, I was assigned at one time to look into civil rights matters, and I took several cases to the people in charge of the FBI headquarters. And during, on those occasions, they specifically told me that they weren't interested in civil rights matters, never have been, weren't now, and never would be. And they would only look into these matters in the case where they were pressured by the media or by public pressure. They said they had to establish the relationship with local police departments, to the National Academy, which is the FBI Academy at Quantico, Virginia, where the FBI bring in police officers from around the nation to create this kind of camaraderie. In fact, it was created by Hoover to do just that, to join local police with federal police. And the supervisor at headquarters specifically told me that they would find it difficult to investigate police officers and brutality cases. And so the cases continue. And as I mentioned and talked about last year and documented in Primetime Live, covered and did an independent investigation in Detroit where Myles Green was beaten to death by two police officers, the FBI, just as they are doing in New York, opened a civil rights investigation. And then at the same time, they had the civil rights investigation going on in the FBI office. FBI agents were holding a fundraiser to pay for the defense of the police officers. So you have the FBI investigating, heading towards prosecution of the police officers, and at the same time raising money for their defense with flyers blatantly placed around the office. And you had members of the media come in to see these flyers, and they didn't care anything about it because this is the way the system has worked and this is the way it continues to work. The numbers indicate that. In 1996, 11,721 complaints, civil rights complaints, most of them police brutality complaints. 2,000 of them are referred, of the 11,000, 2,000 are referred for prosecution, and less than 79 go to court. Out of 11,000 cases, 79 cases, most of them police brutality cases, end up in court, and many of them, you don't even, only 2% of them, you end up with convictions on. Yeah, I think what's important is that, and this can be verified, at the FBI Academy at Quantico, Virginia, they have a behavior science unit. And then that unit, profiles come out of that unit. During the time that I was an agent, profiles came out of that unit, and they actually profile African-Americans in this country as a very emotional people. And the response to that, the strategic response out of the behavioral science unit was that when issues come up like this, the beating of Abner Loima and others, the Malice Green case, that you respond to it in a fashion with press conferences, you create committees and task forces, and eventually it'll go away. The people will move on to another topic. Whereas if you had a scientific response, then there would be no quitting on the issue until you came to some kind of logical conclusion. Everything would be checked out. But they realized that an immediate response of creating task forces, saying the FBI are involved in the case, even with the statistics to show that nothing will probably be done, the immediate response will calm the public fears and send them on to other issues, and then in the end, nothing will be done about the case. And this is not me saying this. This is an FBI profile of what will happen in these major cases. And it comes from the Behavioral Science Unit at Quantico, Virginia, where there are individuals paid to handle what is to determine what will happen and what is the best response to incidents like this. And I'm sure over the last couple of weeks, numerous reports have come out. And the reality of the matter is, in more cases than not, they're not. We'll write about it early on. We'll talk about it on the radio. We'll talk about it on television. And then 6 months from now, we're on to another issue, and the matter hasn't been resolved. And so the thing keeps going on over and over and over again throughout the nation.
Well, there you have it once again. The runaround game, which is why I keep insisting we need to quit playing. From Milwaukee to Florida to Haiti to New Orleans to the Congo to the Sudan, we're being slaughtered by all different types of privatized ideologies. Whether they bend their knees in the form of or towards Jesus or Muhammad or whoever, it doesn't really matter. These are all little methods of control, and we end up in the hangman's noose. Now, is this a coincidence? Are these things just happening to happen to us? And in the same way that we see the runaround that happens when we try to deal with these issues, as long as within the confines of our enemies, whether we're talking about New Orleans or Milwaukee, Florida or Sudan. You just heard the runaround that Cynthia McKinney was getting, and how there is a program to undermine and give us the runaround. At the end of the day, you have a situation where, as this theme has basically tried to outline, our humanity and our indigenous rights and internal rights of self-survival are not respected. You can even look at some of these so-called progressive Arab organizations and see how their map of the Arab world includes the Sudan, even though the Arabs are not a majority and are not indigenous. Yet these same types will cry about how the Zionists of Israel call Israel a Jewish state, even though there's a percentage of Palestinians there, and say that by calling it a Jewish state, they're trying to maintain and put in a particular doctrine and order for the whole of society. But by the same token, by people trying to lay claim to a region of Kush, the region of Nubia that existed before there was even an Islam, Christianity, or Judaism, but let's not let facts get in the way. You see the same mentality and same cycle brewing. It's just groups of various fractions saying that we don't have a right for our own survival and self-determination. Well, for those types that do that, as we've heard throughout this program, who have that mentality, what gives them the right to survive? Let's not fall for the games and tricks and runarounds. Negroes of the planet, stop being Negroes and quit playing. Be what we really are. And oh yeah, and Frank Jude was not beaten down because of his biracial blood. That's just another trick. We know why he was beaten down. And what blood that was coursing through his veins. Those wretched pig dogs were objecting to.
Oh no, it's just another trick. Oh no, it's just another trick. And if they come and ask me, I'm gonna talk. Oh no, it's just another trick. Oh no, it's just another trick. Oh no, it's just another trick. And if they come and ask me, I'm gonna talk. Stretch this message across America's newfound interest in multiculturalism. When the ulterior motive is to kill more quotas, somebody lied, because we've always had apartheid. It's existed for years. By trying multicultural folks didn't just get here. Search out the vote, find their way to stay afloat. Fight the lies and laws that rose to vote for yet another category for minority. Another reason for ignoring we. Some pretty eyed passing boys and girls like the game shame. Curly dudes that hate locks. Only listen to rock and roll like a dog when a master cracks his whip. You like to tap that to sing, so you're a futuristic house negro. You'll be microchips in your own people's afros. Ashamed to choose a dark skin lover. Your mama's white, but you're an other. Pull out the panelist, he's not gonna recognize the melanin in your skin. Pull out the ass, have you been? You come from Jamaica, they'll still hate you. Puerto Rican, Black, Nicky, Spanish, want to ban us when we need to unite. With our heritage, you fight us, we're ashamed. You're half French, one-fourth Indian, white, Mexican, and your great-grandmama's from Brazil.
Thank you.
sister said, scrub off the shame. And, black folks, stop playing. Until the next time. Slave out.